Solutions to support strong families and communities for America's children at AECF.org.
Y'all, Chef John Fals welcoming you to Stirring It Up, the best tasting show on radio. From the swamps and bayous of South Louisiana, thanks for joining us in our little piece of culinary heaven where good cooking is just a way of life. Mornings begin here with a roux simmering in a cast iron pot, and our evenings end with thoughts of what we're going to cook tomorrow. All right, everybody, welcome to the kitchen table today. It's so nice to have you with us. We've locked the screen door because today is Bastille Day. One of my favorite days in French history, the storming of the Bastille. And, of course, in many ways, the reason for the French population of Louisiana. They want to get out of that. They want to get out of it. Come on over here. Anyway, it's great to have all of you here as we celebrate this this wonderful day. And, of course, a lot of our French heritage, a lot of our French history, and, of course, a lot of our French foods originate during this period of time. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's so nice to have you. And, Michelle, I see that you're in your blue and red today. Huh?
Well, you know, had to celebrate.
Yeah, that's celebrated.
Appropriately.
Yeah, yeah. Have you seen Les Miserables?
I saw it in New York many years ago.
Yeah.
Many years ago, but I'm ready to see it again.
Charlie, what about you here? What have you? What about your trips to Paris or New York to see French Revolution?
Well, I did see it in France.
Oh, you just want to be a name dropper, huh? Because we had, huh?
Hey, just so happens.
Mm-hmm. Just so happens. Like, but, you know, there are other interesting theaters in Paris, too. You know, up and down the Champs-Élysées, the Folies Bergères.
Yeah.
That's some other interesting places
Well, as my dad used to say, quit griping, Johnny. Some people are able. Anyway, happy Bastille Day to all of our listeners, and of course, what a great day for our Louisiana French as well. And Michelle, it's so nice to have you sitting in your colors here today. What have you been up to all weekend in preparation for the big celebration? You cooking a French dinner tonight? Maybe a little.
Be a good idea.
Coq au vin, maybe
so.
You still have time. Yeah.
You know, I've been doing a fair amount of studying lately.
Yeah, I know you have.
You know, so I was hoping that maybe you would be making the coq au vin.
I would be happy.
You
to.
And Shirley putting a little something together, and
I would be happy.
You
to.
And the McLaughlin boys, and
I was thinking a really great French wine.
Hey, I'll settle for that.
Well, you cannot cook a good coq au vin without a good French wine.
That's right.
And of course, you drink. Anyway, and Shirley, so what are you? We'll talk about that coq au vin later.
Okay. Yeah. Really. French food. I mean, it's a topic that I guess we could probably talk about forever. And I love French wines. They are so. To me, you know, you go into a store that has a great section of wine, and you make these comparisons, and I have nothing against California wines, but you can get some fabulous deals on French wine.
Then, of course, across the glass wall here, the two guys who know a lot about French wines, that's the McLaughlin boys over there. How are y'all doing?
Hi, John. We're doing great today.
We often plan a show celebrating Bastille Day, which falls just after our own Independence Day and my birthday.
And today is the 34th anniversary of your founding of the company.
That's exactly right.
So happy anniversary to
I
you.
I founded the company July 14th.
Yep.
I think it's appropriate, given our origin as a French colony, to celebrate France's freedom as well here as we do. Remember, many French colonists came to the New World seeking religious freedom, their right to own land, their right to bear arms, which they hadn't had before, their right to hunt off of the king's land. They were setting out to make new lives for themselves. Of course, many French immigrants came to Louisiana in the 17th and 18th centuries following La Salle's discovery of the Mississippi River. Then our wonderful buddies, the brothers Iberville and Bienville's rediscovery some years later, and finally planting the flag of New Orleans over there in the 1720s. Each semester, Shirley and I teach a class on Cajun Creole cuisine at the John Fals Culinary Institute at McNichol State University, where students learn about the history, the culture, and the peoples from what I like to call the seven nations who came and settled Louisiana. They learn about the culinary technique of those nations, of course, the foods that they brought with them, the raw ingredients that became American ingredients from these nations, and of course, preparation styles. They cook so many of the dishes that are part of our cultural and culinary heritage. They learn the influences on the Creole and Cajun foods that make us unique as a state and sought after by everybody looking for good food. They find their way to New Orleans. This got me thinking further about the French influence independently on the cuisine of Louisiana. As early as 1320, wow, 1320, we have a record of the French influence in cuisine. Guillaume Terrell, who is also known as Talleyrand, was employed in the French courts from 1320 until his death in 1395. He wrote La Viande, which was a compilation of recipes, and it gave us a look into the cuisine of France during the 14th and 16th centuries with its use of a wide range of spices. La Viande was the first cookbook printed in the 15th century, and we see the importance of things like pâtés and tarts in French cuisine that we all hear about still today. First time it was ever written about. By the middle of the 17th century, we find changes occurring in French cuisine and of La Varenne in his cookbook, The French Cook. You start to see where the cooks are abandoning the use of all of these spices and replacing them with the native European herbs that things that we know so well today. Parsley, thyme, bay leaves, and basil start to appear in the place of all of these exotic, say, Arabic spices and things like that. Many of these recipes are so popular today, we see them on all these menus. Things like bisque, like the lobster bisque or the crawfish bisque or various ragouts or fricassees, as we like to call them. They're mentioned for the first time in La Varenne's cookbook. He also emphasizes the use of things that are so popular here, roux, in our cooking. We start to see bouquet garnis, which are little satchels put into stews in a cheesecloth of peppercorns and thyme and bay leaves that you can just take out so that the herb doesn't stay in the soup, but the bouquet comes out. And we start to see things like stews and soups mentioned in many varieties. His cookbook was the first French cookbook published in English, La Varenne, 1653. Now, remember, La Salle didn't hit the mouth of the Mississippi until 1689, so this 1653 is about 25 years before La Salle even hit the thing. These are the cooking styles that came with the immigrants to the New World. So when the French arrived in Nova Scotia, well, Acadie, when they arrived in Montreal, when they arrived in Quebec, when eventually they came to New Orleans, these are the styles of cooking that they brought with them, this La Varenne style. You know, Michelle, a French chef, Marie-Antoine Caram, born 1784, which is more of our period, so to speak, he worked as a kitchen boy in a cheap Parisian chop house in exchange for room and board. But in 1798, he apprenticed with a famed French baker, and as they say, the rest, absolute history. Caram was like a duck to water. He gained fame in Paris with his famous piece motifs, which is the elaborate constructions of centerpieces that went onto the tables of these elaborate French banquets. His confections were several feet tall, made entirely out of sugar and marzipan and pastry. I mean, they were castles and they were towers of food in the center of the tables that the centerpieces of the modern table took origin in. Caram was doing 6 and 8 foot pieces back in the 1700s. He was called the King of Chefs and the Chef of Kings, and he set up the design for the modern kitchen. What we call the brigade setup of our kitchen was done by he and his apprenti, who we know so well, George Auguste Escoffier. When we hear the name Escoffier, it ties directly to Caram, and who even furthered the kitchen designs. It was Caram who replaced the classic French style of serving all dishes at one time with what we call Russian service today, or service à la Russe. where courses come to the table one at a time. The soup course first, little pieces of appetizers or something coming to the table. And it was Escoffier and his group that eventually created the chef's uniform in a military jacket, because the kitchen was set up in the brigade style, where everybody had their own job to do, and they were dressed in military style jackets with hats on their heads. And of course, the double-breasted chef coat became popular at that time, and every piece of the kitchen was led by a brigade leader or a general, and that became the sous chefs. You had the general who was the chef, and then you had the sous chefs who came about to run the pastry department, or the saucier who did the sauces, or the rotisseur that did the roasting, and all of these wonderful brigade setups of the kitchen where everybody spoke to one leader. It was also at this time that the chef hat became popular, where the tall chef had the 10 to 12 inch became the executive chef. So when you walked into the kitchen, there weren't epaulets or stars on the collar of the cook to know who was the leader, so you looked at the tallest hat in the kitchen. And then the 8-inch hat became the sous chef, the 6-inch hat became the cooks, and the 4-inch hats became the apprentices. So when you walked into the kitchen, everybody was military and everybody had their hats. And of course, it was Julia Child and Simon Beck and Lisette Bertoli who created the American version of a book from France that was called Mastering the Art of French Cuisine, that brought the French cuisine popular to this country in the 1960s, I think it was, that took place. And of course, again, the rest is history. Right? So as we celebrate Bastille Day, we certainly want to pay homage to our French cooks. We're going to do a great recipe today. Mm-hmm. It is a dish that was made famous in Julia and Julia, in the movie, but it was also made famous by two of the great, great chefs, most famous by the great chef from Lyon, who you ate in his restaurant.
Paul Bocuse,
in his book, Cuisine Bocuse, when he created beef a la bourguignon, beef sautéed or fricasseed or braised in Burgundy wine. And then, of course, Julia Child did the correct technique in Mastering the Art of French Cooking, and Julia made it famous by her drying the meat in paper towels and burning it overnight in the oven. Anyway, y'all, today's going to be a great show. You don't want to miss any of it, because we are giving, I am going to do the beef bourguignon recipe, and it's going to be a lot. We have a great, great two guests, a husband and wife team on the show today, right?
Well, the husband and wife team that put this particular book together, we'll have the wife on today.
Oh, the wife's on today. We're going to be back in a minute.
Everyone, this is Pat Mitchell-Worley, and coming up next time on Bill Street Caravan, we have Alvin Young Bloodheart at the Left Shell in Overton Park in Memphis, Tennessee. Then we'll head to the 2011 International Folk Alliance Conference and hear from Calvin Cook. That, plus our feature host Jim Spake, continues his segments on Crazy About a Saxophone. That's all coming up next time on Bill Street Caravan.
Tonight at 11 on KRVS.
I'm your host, Megan Brown, for Encore. Join me as we journey through the continuing timeline of our culture. We'll discover the music, relive festivals, and get to know the people. Sunday afternoons at 3, here on KRVS.
From the University of Louisiana at Lafayette, this is KRVS, 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles, now broadcasting in HD radio technology.
God, Sean. That's what I want to stand up. Anyway, y'all, welcome back to Stirring It Up, the best tasting show on radio. And today we're celebrating Bastille Day here in the French colony of Nouvelle-Orléans. And, of course, at the same time, the 34th anniversary of Chef John Fawcett and Company, founded 34 years ago. And to think that New Orleans is still so predominantly French in its culture and its food and its style and its joie de vivre and all this other wonderful stuff, right? Anyway, y'all, it's so great that you're at the kitchen table with us today. We appreciate it so much. And Michelle, we have the perfect guest.
Meredith Hughes is our guest today. She and her husband, Tom, are actually the authors of Gastronomy, Food Museums, and Heritage Sites of France.
Oh, I love it.
They have a long interest in food as a museum topic, having created the Potato Museum in Belgium in 1975, one of the first such museum collections to focus on food, and a single food at that. In the United States, they opened the Potato Museum by appointment only on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C., and in the early 90s, they were guest curators for two major food exhibitions, one at the Smithsonian's National Museum of Natural History and one in Ottawa at Canada's National Museum of Science and Technology. Their most recent project, Spuds Unearthed.
I love it.
A 2,500 square foot exhibit supported by educational programming, and that was for the U.S. Botanic Garden on the Mall in D.C. A few years ago, Meredith and Tom traveled 10,000 kilometers. 6,000 miles all around France in 6 weeks. They tracked down the food museums, the food historic sites, and what developed from that trip was their book, Gastronomy. And we are so fortunate to have Meredith with us today. Welcome to Stirring It Up.
Hi, Tom is here as well. Congratulations to your chef on his anniversary. And we also want to give a shout out to Ib Bellew and Carol Kitchell, who in fact contacted us. They are the publishers, Bunker Hill Publishing, of this book. And they contacted us and said, would you like to do a book about the food museums in France? And we said, heavens no, what a horrible notion, you know. But of course we did it, and we had an amazing time. And as you say, we ate quite a bit, didn't we, Tom?
We would get up, have a nice breakfast, and get on the car or get on the route and try to find one of these places, sometimes pretty obscure. This was before GPS. We're just using the Michelin mall. We're doing the driving, going around a lot of trips.
I did all the driving. I did all the wrong calls, all the roundabouts.
We would get completely engrossed in subjects like pâté et foie gras, and then we would have tastings, and then we would have lunch, and then we'd be on the road trying to find another reasonably obscure place, and we would get completely engrossed in prunes, and then we would have to find this wonderful hotel, a dream hotel that anybody would want to stay in and absorb. And as soon as we unpacked, we would have to, then they booked, we had a restaurant to go to where the chef and everybody was waiting to provide us with their specialty of the maison. And then we would be back on the road the next morning doing the same thing. At one point, it really is true. We were so full of fine food and experiences that Meredith, in fact, couldn't go down to dine at a magnificent Puy de Mer offering at a hotel right on the seaside. And I managed to get to the table and do it justice.
I'm delighted that you've showed an interest in our book. One of the sad aspects of this project, however, is that one of the finest museums ever in the world about food has closed. It's called Agropolis. It's mentioned extensively in the book. It's in Montpellier.
And France has more food museums and food heritage sites and traditions and groups dedicated to preserving their heritage than any other place in the world. So it was a wonderful experience for us to get started with this idea of promoting the idea of food heritage sites, places where food history has been made.
They initiated fairly recently Les Sites de la Casa du Goût, and you get a plaque. If your organization has an ongoing food production, if it's beautiful architecture or has an aesthetic interest, and if it allows accessibility to visitors. And this is in addition to what foodies know about the Label Rouge and the AOC and the blah, blah, that other things that individual foods have. France does this. Does the United States? No. Should France has a tradition, a terroir, of honoring not just the soil, which of course is how it would be translated maybe, but also the land, the tradition, the role of the family, and the families through the years, through the generations.
And we're promoting the idea of something like we saw in Beaune, which was a old mustard factory that is a company that is still going on. The family still runs this, and not only are they producing fine mustard, but they are showing people the whole history of mustard production in an original factory building. We are encouraging companies and businesses to preserve their history, and restaurants to preserve their history, to give people, their customers, an experience with, this is our business, this is our life, and many more companies and businesses are doing that. And the French have led the way in helping us promote the idea here in America.
You know, we love the history of food, and we've spent a fair amount of time, most of our time, with 10 books talking about Louisiana in particular, Louisiana's history and heritage and the nations that came. We love the way you started your book, you started the introduction with this quote, "History celebrates the battlefields whereon we meet our death, but scorns to speak of the plowed fields whereby we thrive. It knows the names of the king's illegitimate sons, but cannot tell us the origin of wheat. That is the way of human folly." I love that. Absolutely love that. And so often we talk about, you study history in school, but it's all about the battles that were fought, the kings, but
we
don't talk about the food. You don't talk about the social history.
The food sustains us. Food uplifts us. Food unites us in celebration with family and friends. And yet it has, until, you know, the last 20 years maybe, been totally overlooked by historians, by museums. Now all that is changing, and it's changing very rapidly, and we're very delighted with that, and we hope that we may have had something to do with that as pioneers back in the day, starting the potato museum.
A great American writer who spent a lot of time in France, MFK Fisher, said, "First we eat, then we do everything else." And that kind of guides us into what we do.
Yeah, exactly. And
in your book, you talk about potatoes, of course, being the world's most important vegetable, and you find this reflected in Paris via Antoine-Auguste Parmentier. Share with our audience, of course, the importance of the potato, because I know this is a very important to you all, and its place, where it really fits in the French cuisine.
You know, we used to hear that in cooking schools in France, that a chef, before he passed, they all had to just take a potato and do something original with it. And the idea carried through when a Japanese film crew was doing a story about us and the potato in Washington D.C. We arranged with
Jean-Louis Paladin, who alas is no longer with us.
Oh my God, I loved him.
You remember him?
Watergate. He prepared a meal with every single dish was an original dish that he created from the potato, and there was a separate beverage or wine or whatever that went with it. He got so into this project.
On his day off, he did this with his crew in his tiny little hot kitchen, and the dessert was sweet potato, but of course we'll allow that. it was a remarkable event, and his wife now has, his widow now has a wonderful restaurant or two now, I think, in D.C., and a foundation that continues the work.
And he was one of the original people to locally source his, and we were talking to him about his source for the potatoes and everything. This is a man who typified the French respect for potatoes.
Jean-Louis was a really great, not only friend, but mentor. I worked with him in his kitchen at the Watergate often, and then as he moved not only to Las Vegas, but then to his final restaurant in New York. In fact, Michelle as well, we talk often about our last great piece of, our last great meal in foie gras came from Jean-Louis, long before he passed away.
Yeah, I cut my teeth on Jean-Louis' foie gras, I am proud to say.
But getting back to the importance of the potato, to Northern Europeans, the potato saves them. They say it saves them from starvation. It enables them to feed their families in small pots, healthily, and so on. And the French, in particular, Parmentier started to create soup kitchens in which he used potato soup to feed poor.
Olivier Dessert, we went to his home. He was one of the early breeders of potatoes, way before Formosier.
Yeah.
And he is recognized. But one of the wonderful things that happens when you visit all of these places in France is that frequently the tour ends with a tasting. And
You go to other museums. At the end, you don't get a little goodie. But when you're learning about mushrooms or ham or foie gras, you definitely get a tasting. And the foie gras. Oh, that's really. I'm getting hungry now. Tom.
You know, the range of museums and exhibits that dedicated people have put together in France is really astounding and inspiring. One time, we were kind of a little off track and we'd gotten lost, and we arrived at a museum of old utensils in a small town in the west of France, and it seemed like the entire town was waiting to greet us. And they welcomed us into their museum. This collection had been put together. They were so proud of it. And I think of all of the museums and all of the objects and exhibits that I saw in this trip, some of the things that they had collected and they were so proud of were offered. There was one, it's so many things. We stayed in touch with them. And
Musée des Ustensiles de Cuisine in Saint-Denis-la-Chevache. A lovely place, lovely little museum.
Yeah, people have put exhibits up on wine corkscrews, wine corkscrews. I mean, the imagination and the effort to preserve is truly remarkable.
We must indeed recognize the Southern Food and Beverage Museum in New Orleans. Liz Williams, the president, has done something really remarkable with her people there, and she, in fact, is doing a series of columns for foodmuseum.com about how SOFAB, as they call it, got started. But this is the kind of thing that we would love to see all over the country, naturally.
Sure.
In the world.
In reading your book, what I thought was it was so interesting to go from story to story and place to place, and I couldn't help but realize that as you gather, you get all these amazing stories about people. And you mentioned one story I remember very much was with Christine and Eve, is it Herrin, who preserved pears in a traditional way by drying them. I mean, there are so many stories about the people that you meet. Are there any particular that just really stick with you?
Well, we were just talking about a woman who trained to work in vineyards and ended up not finding a job and became a snail
breeder.
And I'm trying to find her now in the book.
Interesting.
Fascinating woman.
We arrived in a small town trying to find the history of saffron, Southside Paris, and there was a supposedly saffron museum, and it was closed and not many visitors, but somebody ran down the street, they pulled the monsieur who was the curator, he came in, he opened the place up, and some of the things were directly, I mean, he besides saffron, which was a long-gone occupation, and many of these places, by the way, are bygone exhibits. They don't have the industry anymore. Mm-hmm. But he then, above the exhibit was this huge net which they used to trap larks. And they had this curious little device. He told us that he made it, which would track the larks, and then they would net them. And of course, it's illegal to do now. But as he said to us, in the old days, there wasn't that much to eat, and we had to eat whatever was available.
Yeah, sure, exactly.
Well, we have one last question. This is such an interesting interview. I can't believe we're already through it.
Michelle, while they were talking so passionately about their experiences, I couldn't help but think that they are, I mean, you are so close as a couple to Michael and Ariane Batterbury. I mean, you are unbelievable as I listen to the two of you talk. I could talk to you for hours, which I know we will, but Michelle, I know we run out of time, so one last question.
As you were saying, the French seem to have museums or historic sites, just about everything food, and we've touched on so many, but in looking through the book, almond, apples, bees, cheese, chocolate, octopus, oysters, I mean, just on and on. And while it might be like asking, who is your favorite child, did you have one favorite place or one of your top 10 that if you went back, that's where you'd make a beeline?
Well, there is a restaurant, and the chef is named Dede Del Monte, and it's called Morin des Morts, and it's in Provence. And this man is an entire encyclopedia of food history. He served up a real bouillabaisse, served on a large slab of cork, and we quote him in the book. He said, these touristy restaurants will serve the same food, not as good, of course, on a silver platter. We'll charge you for the platter, he says, laughing.
I love it.
That was one of the great experiences with him, and his red sauce, sauce Rosalie, done by his mother, was a remarkable sauce based on anchovies, tomato, and so on. I mean, that's just one of many.
I think right in the end of the book, when we were on our way back to Charles de Gaulle Airport, we stopped at a very mixed community of immigrants, basically, only the Tirbois, and we stopped to get some at a traiteur, and there was a line out the door, and when we finally got in, we carefully watched how all of these immigrant populations living in France, living in suburban Paris, were all treated with respect. They all got to select what they wanted, and on display in this very multi-ethnic community was like a panorama of all of the foods and cheeses that we had seen and preserved. It was like a wonderful little closing to our trip. Unbelievably, this same community went up in flames a few years later with ethnic strife, but
oh,
I mean, we
God.
Remember it for the food that connected all these people.
Well, you know, we will have to have you all on the show again. I know we're running out of time here, and I apologize. And we will have to have you back. Do you actually still do trips, or do you recommend trips to people who want to follow your book as a tour guide? Do you recommend things, or do you still take trips there?
Well, we have not been to France since we did this book, but we have been to Alaska, and we now have a new blog about Eats Alaska. We are working on a project about Florida called Eat Florida, and we have also, last summer, we went to New Zealand, Australia, Bali, and...
Wow.
so we're always working on new...
Well, yeah,
we'd love to go back to work with somebody on a tour group or something.
Oh, we'd love to. I mean, we could be tour guides. I mean,
yes, we could.
New people. We want to come and visit you.
We're opening a brand new restaurant we want to talk to you about in New Orleans, Restaurant Revolution, which follows the exact theme of your book we're going to talk about later. So thank y'all so much for being with us. And and y'all were absolutely magnificent. And thanks for your fabulous work. It's an important piece of our culinary collection. Thank y'all so much.
Thanks so much for inviting us.
Thank you.
And we're going to be back. Bon appetit. We'll be right back, y'all.
For a youthful perspective on classical music?
Well, I'm going to play the Liszt Transcendental Etude number 7. It's very exciting and energetic, and there's hard-hitting parts and soft parts, and overall, it's a pretty good piece.
Look no further than From the Top. Join me, Christopher O'Reilly, for our 10th anniversary season, each week right here on NPR.
Tuesday night at 7 on KRVS.
Soy Fernando Pérez Villar. Únanse a mi programa Espacio Latino este domingo a las 5 p.m. para que escuche buena música latina e información sobre la cultura latina aquí en el sur de Louisiana.
That's Espacio Latino, coming up this Sunday evening at 5 here on KRVS.
Regional Public Radio for Acadiana, KRVS-FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles.
Les aristocrates on les prendra. La Troie sans ans qui nous promette qu'on va nous accorder du pain. La Troie sans ans qui donne des fêtes et qui entretiennent des cadins. La Troie sans ans qu'on nous écrase, assez de mensonges et de phrases. On ne veut plus mourir de faim.
Right, everybody, that's Edith Piaf, the great French singer, known, that song is Little Sparrow.
Yeah, she was known as the Little Sparrow. She was so tiny, but boy, she had a voice that really encapsulated France.
Yeah, I mean, and of course, her Mercier, everybody, and she was a great singer. Yeah, Michelle, I felt that I've just been on the roller coaster of an interview with Tom and Mary. They were absolutely fabulous as a team, but they were like the team of Michael and Ariane Battaberry, and he just passed away. That's why I mentioned
he did. We lost him in 2010. And I mean, can you imagine a dinner with them? You know, we talk a lot and we could barely get a word in. That's an accomplishment itself. Well, and you're just hung on every word.
Because they represent the passion of their interest. I mean, my God, when you can be that passionate about your interest and do such a great book, Gastronomy, you have to look it up. I mean, it's absolutely fantastic.
And it's a small book. It's not a large book, but it's packed with great information. But, I know Shirley's going to tell us about it later.
But you know, y'all, one of the greatest influences on French cuisine in our own cuisine was a name I mentioned just a little while ago. You know him as Escoffier. You hear about it, George Auguste Escoffier. He was born in 1846, 100 years before I was, in a village near Nice. During his lifetime, he was called the finest cook I ever met by the famous Cesar Ritz, who founded the Ritz-Carlton Hotel chain. He spent time during the First World War in the military, and this experience taught him the importance of preserving food. He began methods of canning meats and vegetables in sauces. We have Escoffier to thank for such wonderful desserts that just took the world by storm. Peach Melba, named after the great opera singer who just happened to come through France, and he created a dish for her dinner out of peaches because it was her favorite fruit, and he created Peach Melba. Cherish Jubilee for the Jubilee presentation in the Jubilee year he created for them.
Well, you know, you were talking about Escoffier. We've had some fabulous chefs that have really put their mark on Louisiana cuisine over the decades,
if you think about it. You don't have to think much.
In Baton Rouge, Charles Brandt. I mean, fabulous restaurant in Baton Rouge that closed just a few years back. But he brought French cuisine to our capital city, and his tradition is being carried on today by one of his sons at his restaurant, Brandt's Maisonette.
Right, exactly.
And of course, Leon Galatoire founded Galatoire's in New Orleans, Count Arno of Arno's, our good friend Chef Dominique Maquette. He's got a great restaurant in the city of New Orleans now. And of course, in 71, Louis XVI was opened by Danielle
Bonnet. And Danielle was he had a sister restaurant called La Scala. And today he's trained some of the greatest chefs in Louisiana. I mean, Susan Spicer, Darling, all. I mean, just Chef Selman. A lot of great chefs who learned from Danielle. Today he teaches a cooking school in the south of France in a little bed and breakfast. And I can imagine just knocking on the door because Danielle was a very good friend of mine as well. He opened the Eiffel Tower restaurant on St. Charles Avenue in New Orleans. That failed when they brought the Eiffel Tower from Paris to New Orleans after the renovation. Most people don't even remember when that happened. And it's right there still today, sitting on St. Charles Avenue. And I dream of opening a restaurant in that building one day. I have to open a restaurant in the Eiffel Tower in New Orleans, right there. But French chefs have influenced the cuisine of Louisiana since its founding, and I dare say that that's not going to stop. I mean, I think some of the greatest food and sort of combinations of food certainly come from come from French origin. So, Shirley, what about some of the books? I mean, we're always talking about building that library. I'm always begging people to go to our site and choose
and
these books because
right.
we look for so many books on the subject that our library grows, and we want your library to grow as well.
Well, I think that's true, and with the publishing world as it is, there's so many books available and so many to choose from. Sometimes if we can give someone an idea of a first book, then they can explore beyond that, and I have a couple to choose from. For those who are interested in the history of French chefs, a new book that was out is called The Cooking for Kings, The Life of Antoine Carême, The First Celebrity Chef, by the English author Ian Kelly. And it's a very interesting, it's just purely a biography and a kind of a history of the time. And it has some of the drawings of some of these centerpieces you were talking about, John. And you look at them and think, I can't even imagine. They couldn't even do it today. I can't even imagine how he did it back then. And then on the practical side, I really do recommend, in spite of some of the disasters you saw in Julia, I really do recommend Julia Child's 2-volume set, Mastering the Art of French Cooking. It's available in paper and in hardcover. Lots of new editions as time goes on, but it really is a fabulous book, a set of books. So I recommend them both, the practical and the rather historical. So,
and then of course, Tom and Meredith Hughes' book,
Gastronomy.
Yeah. I mean, and as
and
they were saying,
on our list. Mm-hmm.
A true food guide
through
France.
And now that you know them personally, I mean, it's a great idea to have that
that's
book.
That's right.
That book on the shelf. And you know, Shirley, one of the things that I really enjoy is going to either the bookstores or certainly going online and looking for these books, like the twin set of Mastering the Art of French Cooking.
Right.
A lot of times, even important books like this, you can find at discounted rates available in the marketplace. You can find them often. You can find them in these rummage sales
That's
and
right.
all. I mean, so as you wander around, go to the book section. But go online. You can find these great books. You have to make them a part of your library, and they are less expensive in most cases.
And if you're not sure, don't forget your public libraries. Our library here, I know the one I go to on Bluebonnet has a huge culinary section in their library. And so if you're not sure you want to buy it, go borrow it and see what you think. And if you like it, then you can always go out and get it. But there are very few books, at least in Louisiana culinary and in great cuisine, that you can't also find at the library as well. So there's no excuse for not trying something new and exciting when it comes to food.
Well, you know, y'all, I had the, I chose my recipe today, and I did choose bourguignon because not only because of the movie, I know everybody saw Julian, and she cooked, that was her piece that had to be done for her guests coming to show her expertise in cooking. She made the beef bourguignon, and of course, in the movie, she burned it and all of
disaster.
That, and it was a disaster. But, knowing Julia Child myself, having met Julia and worked with Julia on numerous occasions on dinners that we did around the country, I just absolutely love Julia Child because you could sit down with her. And when I think back on the occasions that I had to sit with Julia, just the two of us,
right.
I remember one day at Fetzer Vineyards in California. It was an afternoon. I walked into the tent where we were going to be cooking for dinner that night, and here was Julia by herself, peeling tomatoes, or tomatoes, she said, tomatoes. And I walked in and I said, Julia, I said, do you need a hand? Oh, of course I do. I'm peeling tomatoes. You always need a hand when you peel tomatoes. So anyway, to sit across the table from her and realize for the moment it's Julia and I, and not to know the importance of that moment at the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I didn't realize that. It was just Julia peeling tomatoes.
Well, you know, sometimes I think you can get lost in a moment like that, too, because it's so surreal.
Yeah.
It's not that you don't want to you know, embrace it. You just, you can be overwhelmed by it.
Well, you know, and it was one of the first times I had met her, and she was so down to earth. And then, of course, she came to New Orleans, and I cooked with her in New Orleans. Then she came to White Oak Plantation, and the thing that Julia and Robert Mondavi were walking around White Oak Plantation, my property in Baton Rouge, tasting
wine. Little boy
wine.
From St. James Parish.
Yeah, I mean, but yet, mm-hmm. not to just relish that moment,
sure.
to think that these two people might not be with us, Paul, and
right.
I need to understand this moment is very important to me as a cook. It'd be like if I met Karam or Escoffier and not realize how important it was a moment, because we were all just cooks, you know.
I love when you tell the story. Didn't Mr. Royley, your dad, didn't he meet Robert Mondavi?
Yeah. I shouldn't tell this story because I'm going to run out of beef in your time. But yeah, Daddy was sitting at the table with Mondavi because I invited him to the dinner at White Oak, and Mondavi was talking about all attributes of the fine of the wine that he and Rothschild had put together, the Opus 1.
Mm-hmm.
And Dad leaned over to the table and he says, "You think you make good wine? You ought to taste the wine my son makes." And I'm thinking to myself, oh, my God. Now, here's my brother making cherry bounce in a crock, and Daddy's saying, "You ought to taste the wine my son makes." And Mondavi said, "Really? He's in the vineyard business." And Daddy said, "Oh, you can't believe what he makes." You know? Just as a daddy from St. James would do, you know.
Absolutely.
But anyway, I have some great stories. We need to tell stories about food one day and the people we've met along the way. I have some great ones. Anyway, y'all, I have 5 minutes to tell you about, I teach the version of Julia Child's recipe for beef bourguignon at my culinary school at Nicholls State University. Each semester, my students have to make it. And you don't have to be afraid, you know, of French cooking. It's really easy. I mean, it's all about following technique and sense. The only difference is that a lot of time in Louisiana, we think, you know, 2 cups of onions, a cup of celery, or half a cup of bell pepper, throw some green onions, parsley. And sometimes these are a little bit too much in classic French cuisine. But I have to tell you that the recipe for the beef bourguignon, let me grab my page here. There it is. I didn't want to miss it. Anyway, this recipe, and then to eat it at Paul Bocuse's restaurant as well in France, where his coq au vin, his beef bourguignon. I mean, people travel continents to eat the food. Now, this recipe is typical of French country technique. So yeah, and of course this was the foods of New Orleans as well. The dish calls for Burgundy wine that's used not only for flavoring, but for tenderizing the meat as well. Y'all, you're going to begin with 3 pounds of cube beef chuck cut into 2-inch cubes. So once you get those 2-inch cubes, then you're going to dry them really nice. Both Julia Child and Bocuse recommend that you wrap the meat in either paper towels or in cloth or in muslin cloth and just squeeze it real hard to take all the moisture out of the meat. Otherwise, it won't brown and caramelize properly to flavor this dish. So you have to dry it really good. 1/3 cup of flour, 1/4 cup of vegetable oil, 4 slices of bacon chopped into 1/4-inch slices because you need that wonderful bacon flavor. And you also need the lardons, the little pieces of dried bacon that comes out of sautéing. 2 cups of diced onions, 2 carrots sliced, and the recipe is on our website. So you're going to find the garlic and the mushrooms and the burgundy. Let me tell you how we put it together. In a large mixing bowl, we season the meat after it's been dried really well, like squeeze it in a towel, get all that mush out. Season the meat with salt and pepper. You coat it well with flour and just kind of a light flour, not too much, just dust it a little bit. In a cast iron Dutch oven, you're going to heat the oil over medium-high heat, and you're going to add the bacon to it, and you're going to saute the bacon until golden brown, and then you take the bacon out, and now you have this bacon fat-flavored oil, and then you're going to brown the meat, as Paul Bocuse and Julia Child said, long and slow. Do not rush it. Turn those 2-inch pieces of cubed beef often so you get that good caramelization on all sides. The point of the flour is not only to help brown it, but to thicken it, to thicken the sauce have this kind of the roux that you're making by having the meat slightly coated in the flour. So you're going to brown it on all sides, and you're going to caramelize it on the bottom of the pot. You're going to get those grimis, as we call it, down on the bottom of that pot. That's what you're looking for. And of course, you're going to remove the meat, and you're going to keep it warm. And into that same pot, you're going to saute the onions, which are 2 cups. You're going to saute, you're going to add the carrots, and you're going to add the garlic, which is about a quarter cup of sliced or minced garlic. And you're going to saute that for 3 to 5 minutes or until the vegetables are all well blended. You're going to add the mushrooms, which are 2 cups of sliced mushrooms, very important in the dish, and then 3 cups of burgundy wine. Remember, the flour's down there, and it's going to start to thicken it very little, but it will thicken. You're going to add the bacon that you cooked just a minute ago, those 4 slices of bacon that was cubed. You're going to put them back into the pot. You're going to add 4 cups of beef broth to that, 1 tablespoon of tomato paste. You're going to throw in 1 whole bay leaf and 1/2 teaspoon of thyme and 24 pearl onions that have been cleaned nicely. Today you can go into some of the big stores and the pearl onions already peel for you, but they're easy to peel, so don't be afraid of them. You're going to add the meat back into the pot, stir it well into that wine and all of that stock and flavors. Bring it to a rolling boil, and then you can do one of 2 things. I like to put it in a casserole dish at that point and put it into an oven, tightly covered, and then you just allow it to sit there and braise in that oven for 1.5 to 2 hours until that sauce thickens with that wine and stock and all those beautiful flavors. Or you can leave it on top of the stove in your cast iron pot, simmering very, very low for about 2.5 hours, again, as it cooks. I like the oven technique because at 375 in the oven, you make sure the stock is boiling before you put it in there. It is absolutely, you will never taste a better dish. In fact, cooked right, most chefs think beef bourguignon is the perfect and most flavorful dish you can absolutely cook yourself. Just unbelievable. As hard as that is to believe, that you're measured by your beef bourguignon because there's technique involved there. Anyway, y'all, the recipe is on the website, jfalls.com. Go to Stirring It Up. It's all right there. And remember the French. They founded us and cooked a little bit.
This is Cheryl Castile. Join me each week on The Exchange when we'll hear the stories and meet the people that make South Louisiana such a wonderful place to call home. Tuesdays at 1 p.m., Wednesdays at 3 a.m. here on listener-supported public radio, KRVS 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles.
This is Helen Forster from E-Town. Don't forget to tune in this week. We've got Joshua Radin with us for his very first visit, plus the brother and sister duo Sarah and Christian Dugas, and of course the winner of the Achievement Award this week in E-Town.
Coming up Tuesday at noon here on KRVS.
Daddy Cecil here. For 2 hours of word sound power, Rasta Reggae Radio, it's Jam On.